Anastasia Pagonis is a 14-year-old who goes by Tas for short. He lives in Garden City. We got to know their family about 10 years ago when we were living in Nassau County and serving at a different church. And Tas started to have a challenge around the age of 11 years old that most of us could never really imagine dealing with. She discovered that she has something called Stargardt disease, which in essence is a disorder that causes progressive blindness. It was a shock when they first started to realize that this was happening. Her vision basically is peripheral only. So if you can imagine putting a fist about 1 inch in front of one eye and then closing the other eye, what you can see around the edge of your fist is pretty much all that Tas can see. She quickly discovered some workarounds for daily life, how to do things. She discovered an app that will read labels at the grocery store when she's shopping for something, or she can make her iPhone read text messages to her. She's figured out how to look at someone directly in conversation, even though to see them she would have to actually look off to the side, but she's figured out how to work around that. Her mom says that, you know, there are a number of dangers in daily life because of this vision impairment. Newsday did an article on Tas last fall, and her mom said, yeah, it's like 30 times a day that I'll hear somebody tumble down the stairs, and then I'll wait a couple of seconds, and I'll hear, don't worry, Mom, I'm okay, and then I'll breathe a sigh of relief. Not only has Tas figured out how to do the things of daily life, she's also figured out how to swim really well. She's such a good swimmer that she's gone to the Paralympics a few times. This is different from the Special Olympics. This is for elite athletes who have some kind of physical disability. She's so good that this past December, she won several gold medals at the Paralympic championships out west. As much as science has afforded us in the area of blindness, as much as Tas and her family are going to the best specialists in New York City and the Northeast, she's still blind. Her condition is still getting worse. They still haven't figured out how to stop it. And I wonder today, if we think about our spiritual sight as seriously as we think about our physical sight. See, if that was any of us, we would probably do whatever we had to be able to see fully. And yet I think that most of us are, to some degree at least, spiritually blind. We may have kind of peripheral vision, but there's a lot that we don't see spiritually. And kind of like Tas, we've figured out workarounds, way to get through life without ever really having to do anything about it. But what if we could really see clearly? The stories that we're looking at today in Mark's gospel are about sight. The physical kind to some degree, but especially the spiritual kind. And we're thinking specifically about how we see Jesus, because most of us really only have a partial glimpse of Jesus. Now, of course, there's a way in which we're going to be growing all throughout our lives in our understanding of Jesus and what we see about him. But today I want you to see two very important aspects of Jesus' character, Jesus' identity. And then to wrap things up, we're going to see what that says about who we are. I'm going to invite you today to follow along as we read through the stories in Mark chapter 8, starting in verse 22. And if you're using the Bible from one of the chairs in front of you, you can find this on page 1570. 1570, Mark chapter 8. Now, I have to say, this is one of my favorite stories in all of Mark's gospel. This is actually where we got the name for this whole sermon series that we're doing this winter, Coming into Focus. I've been away recently, and just first service I was coming up, and I stopped because I was waiting for that image to come into focus. I was thinking we were having screen problems again, and then I realized, oh no, that's the point, silly. But this is where we got the name from the story that we're going to see today, Coming into Focus. We see a miracle of healing that Jesus does, and it has implications far beyond what we see physically. First, let's get a little bit of context here. A few weeks ago, we looked at Mark chapter 6, a story where Jesus miraculously feeds a large crowd of people, 5,000 men plus women and children. Now, two chapters later, in the beginning of chapter 8, we see a very similar scenario start to play out. Jesus is out teaching. He's surrounded by a crowd of thousands of people, 4,000 men this time, in the middle of nowhere. His disciples are there. The day is almost over, and people are hungry. Only this time, Jesus is the one who takes the initiative to make an issue of it. And he's doing it so it'll be a way to test his disciples. He says, "Hey guys, come here. Look at this. We got thousands of hungry people here. It's late in the day. If we send them home now, they're going to collapse on the way from hunger. What are we going to do about it, guys?" And he expects, and we expect, that the 12 disciples are going to go, "Okay, Jesus, you're not going to get one over on us this time. We know how this works. This is the one where you take the fish and the loaves and you turn it into a feast to feed thousands of people so much that they're stuffed and we have leftovers because you're the Son of God and you do that kind of thing." That's what we expect. But it's not what happens. They panicked again. They didn't get it. Jesus does the miracle anyway. He feeds everybody. And then he gets on a boat to come back to kind of his home territory. And he has this kind of debrief conversation with the disciples. And he asks them a very probing question. Chapter 8, verse 17. He says, "Do you still not see or understand? Don't you see who I am, guys? I mean, I've done all these things in front of you." Now, fortunately for them and for us, even though they're thick-headed, Jesus doesn't give up on them. Jesus doesn't give up on us. He continues to probe us throughout our lives. And the next miracle that we read about, our focal story for today, is when the disciples really start to see. In fact, this whole narrative, in just three short verses, verses 23 to 25, it's all built around the motif of seeing. That there's in these few verses in the Greek language that Mark wrote in, there are eight different words for seeing, for vision. It's that important. So let's look at that story starting in verse 22. "They came to Bethsaida, and some people brought a blind man and begged Jesus to touch him. He took the blind man by the hand and led him outside the village. When he had spit on the man's eyes and put his hands on him, Jesus asked, 'Do you see anything?' He looked up and said, 'I see people. They look like trees walking around.' Once more, Jesus put his hands on the man's eyes. Then his eyes were opened, his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. Jesus sent him home, saying, 'Don't even go into the village.'" Now, I want to demonstrate what this might have been like. I'm going to ask a helper to come up. Stephen Benz, would you just come up for a second? I've got some mud here, and I'm just going to spit on this and then rub it on your eyes. No, I'm kidding. Sit back down. Thanks for trusting me, though, Steve. I know I can always count on you. This is pretty weird, isn't it? I mean, what's up with the spit in the story? We're really not sure, honestly. Commentators go back and forth about this. We know that in the first century Greek culture, that for certain people with healing power, their saliva was thought to be magical. But if we look at all the Gospels, we know that it's not like that's the one special key for Jesus, because he only does this with the saliva a couple of times, and there are many, many healing miracles where he will heal with a touch of his hand, or he'll heal by speaking a word. Sometimes he heals with a thought from far away. So it's not like the saliva is the one magical ingredient. But you know what puzzles me about the story even more than that? The fact that the miracle doesn't take the first time. Did that ever bother you if you've read this before? I mean, Jesus touches the guy. He's going to make him see again. He asks, "Can you see?" And the guy's like, "Well, sort of, but it's all really blurry." Can you imagine what the disciples must have thought in this moment? I mean, Peter is off to the side going, "James, did you hear what I just heard? Jesus just had his first fail. Can you believe it? Is he losing his touch?" And James is like, "No, I think his hand was a little too far to the right. I think he needed to kind of come more inside the eye that way." And while they're over there chattering, Jesus asks the guy, and he touches him again, and suddenly he can see clearly. And the guys are like, "Wow, Jesus, you really had us worried that time. We thought this was going to be the one you couldn't heal. But this wasn't an accident. This wasn't a fail. This is exactly the way Jesus intended to do the miracle. This is the only time in four Gospels where a miracle doesn't seem to work the first time. But it's very intentional that Jesus does this. You see, he's not only showing compassion to this man, but he's actually acting out a little teaching parable for his disciples. Because he's getting ready to open their eyes. He's getting ready to give them a new kind of spiritual sight. And yet it's going to happen in stages. They're not going to see everything at once. And we can see that. We can see that that's what's going on here in verse 23. When Jesus asks the question, he says to the blind man, "Do you see anything?" Now that should be ringing a bell based on the preceding story that we just looked at when Jesus is on the boat, remember? And he says to the disciples, "Do you still not see?" Now he's going to repeat almost the exact same phrase to the blind man. This should catch their attention. Okay, this is not just a healing miracle. He's asking the same thing he just asked us. And he's doing it this way so that they will see what's about to happen with them and to give us a picture of how our spiritual sight comes about. We finally get a glimpse of the first aspect of who Jesus is in verses 27 through 30. Mark says, "Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi." That would be about a 25-mile walk to the north of where they were. So at least a full day of hiking, plenty of time to talk on the way. On the way, he asked them, "Who do people say I am?" Jesus was brilliant with human psychology. See, it's very safe to ask people somebody else's opinion, right? If I asked you, "What does CNN think of our president?" You could all answer because it's not a secret. It would be safe because you're not stating your opinion, you're stating somebody else's opinion, right? It's kind of loosening up their lips, getting them a little icebreaker question here. You can always answer somebody else's opinion. But what if I say, "Hey, what's your opinion of our president?" Oh, hold on a minute. Let's not go there. That's a sensitive issue, right? We don't want to say in public. I mean, we'll have people all over the spectrum. But Jesus asks that question to get him warmed up for what's coming. And the disciples answer, verse 28, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, still others say one of the prophets." They say, "You're up there, Jesus, with the greatest humans in history. I mean, you're like one of the superheroes in the Jewish faith, Jesus. You're up there with all of them." And then he takes it a bit deeper, verse 29. "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" That's the reaction I think probably happened. Silence. They're looking around. "Oh, you want me to go there? Me?" And then eventually they all look at Peter because he's the one who's never afraid to talk. Just steps right in it, right? Peter answered, "You are the Messiah." For once, Peter gets it right. "You're the Messiah." He's saying, "You're greater than all of those people, Jesus. You're greater than any human comparison we could possibly think of." Verse 30, Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. Now, Peter is speaking as a representative of the disciples here. This is not just his opinion. They've kind of, you know, pushed him forward to say what they're all thinking. "You're the Messiah." What does that mean exactly? Messiah is the same word as Christ. You know, when we say Jesus Christ, Jesus Messiah, same thing. In Hebrew, it literally meant anointed one. But in the first century Jewish world, it had come to have a very specific connotation. Messiah was going to be a king, but not just any king. The king who would end all kings. The king who God would send to make everything right. To put away all oppression, all injustice, to reign forever and ever. To bring God's kingdom to bear on all of creation. That's who the Messiah was going to be. And when Peter says, "Jesus, you are the Messiah," he's saying, "We've finally gotten it. We finally see it." Now, if you've been tracking with us through Mark's gospel, this question, "Who is Jesus? Who do you say that I am?" That's really been the key question hanging over the whole thing so far. It showed up in one of those early miracles where Jesus calmed the storm with the disciples in the boat. And after he did, they say, "Who is this man?" Now, we've seen the answer a couple of times, right? Who's answered? God answered, chapter 1, when Jesus was baptized. He said, "This is my son." Who else answers? Demons, spiritual beings, whenever Jesus casts them out, they say, "You are the Son of the Most High God." They know who he is, right? No human being up until this point has gotten it. And finally, Peter and the other 11, they get it. They see who Jesus is. And this is the first aspect of Jesus' identity that I want you to not miss. He is the divine king. He is the one who came to usher in God's everlasting kingdom. Now, that's not new to you probably because we've been seeing that in various ways over the last few weeks. But please, don't miss. Jesus is not just another religious figure on that list of people that the disciples just said. He's not just another Elijah or Moses or Muhammad or Confucius or Buddha or anybody who has been a great religious teacher. He's not just somebody else coming to give you a good example of a moral life to follow. He's not just somebody coming from God to tell you how to work really hard to get back to God. Jesus is the one and only who came to bring God to you, who came to bring heaven to earth, who came to do for you what you could never do for yourself. He is uniquely the divine king, and it is so important that you see this. If you don't, the Christian faith will never make sense to you. The Bible will never make sense to you. It'll just seem like a system of rules that's impossible for you to keep up with. Jesus is the divine king who came to do something for you that you could never do for yourself. And yet, while Peter and the disciples have finally gotten that, they've used the right title, Messiah, King, they still have the wrong understanding. Now, to think about this, the healing of the blind man as a picture of this, what's happening here, in that moment where the blind man is partially seeing, but it's all still really blurry, that's how the disciples are right now in their spiritual sight. They have a partial truth about who Jesus is, but you know, a partial truth is really more dangerous sometimes than an all-out lie. Because it's believable. I mean, you could go to first grade and learn that the Wright brothers came up with a way for human beings to fly. And if you go up on the roof with Lou, who likes to go up on the roof sometimes, and you jump off because you think human beings can fly, you're going to have a very rude awakening when you hit the ground. Because it's just a partial truth, isn't it? And if you just have a partial truth of Jesus, that he's the king, you're missing something very important. It's going to be very dangerous. And so now, this question of what's the other aspect of who Jesus is? What kind of king is he? That's the question that the rest of Mark's gospel is going to focus on. This is like a watershed moment. This is the continental divide in the gospel of Mark. Everything from here on changes. After Peter and the disciples get this first part, the focus changes. Jesus is no longer roaming around Galilee up in the north. He's on a beeline for Jerusalem. Jesus is no longer spending lots of time with the crowds. He's focusing on the 12 mostly because it's so crucial that they see this next part. What kind of king is Jesus? What's the answer? What's so important here? We see what they're missing in verse 31. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. Now, this doesn't sound surprising to you if you've read the Bible before, if you've been to church before, that Jesus was going to die. But for these 12 disciples, they haven't heard anything about suffering yet, anything about Jesus dying. And in their eyes, a Messiah doesn't suffer. This was the last thing that they would expect to hear. The Messiah was a conquering king who would defeat all of God's enemies and ride into Jerusalem on a white horse and go straight to the palace and sit on a throne and rule forever and ever. He doesn't suffer. They knew the prophecies of the Messiah. Now, when Jesus uses the term for himself here, the Son of Man must suffer, that just really ratchets up the tension. You know why? You know what the phrase Son of Man is referring to? In Hebrew, it originally just meant a human being. It was a way of speaking of a human. But in Daniel chapter 7, hundreds of years before Jesus, the prophet Daniel had a vision where he said, I saw one like a Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven. One who looked like a human being, but who came with all the authority of God himself to rule over God's creation forever and ever. And so when Jesus calls himself the Son of Man, he's saying, I am that one. Yes, the Messiah, that kind of king. But then he says, I am the Son of Man, but I'm going to have to suffer and die. And they're thinking, what? All of Israel, all of our people, we've never heard about a suffering Messiah. Now, you might push back and say, well, weren't there the prophecies about a suffering servant, Isaiah 53, other places? Of course, yes. But up until this point, nobody in the whole Jewish world associated Messiah with suffering servant. They thought they were two different people, not one and the same. Jesus says, yep, I'm the Messiah, but I've come to suffer and die for you. He's saying, listen, not only is he saying we got to be careful, these leaders might trip us up, you know, they're trying to trap us, and if they do, we're gonna suffer. That's not what he's saying. He's saying, I came to exercise my kingship precisely by suffering and dying for you. That's the only way it's gonna work. And this is the other indispensable aspect of Jesus' identity that I need you to see today. What kind of king is he? He's the suffering king. That's how he came to do for you what you could never do for yourself. James Edwards wrote a commentary on Mark's gospel, and I think he captures well what a shock this would have been. He says, when Jesus finally speaks of his messianic status, it is not to claim the common understanding of Messiah, but to redefine it practically beyond recognition. Not only does Jesus not fit the messianic stereotype, but he defines his mission in scandalous contrast to it. The meaning of his life and mission is not about victory and success, but about rejection, suffering, and death. It's so unthinkable what Jesus has just said that Peter thinks Jesus must now be in league with Satan because messiahs don't suffer. And so listen to what happens, verse 32. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. You know what that word rebuke is? It's the word that shows up when Jesus casts out demons. He rebukes them. Peter is speaking to Jesus as if he's in league with Satan. Messiahs don't die. But then look at verse 33. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. Get behind me, Satan, he said. That's pretty harsh, isn't it? You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns. You see, Jesus is saying to Peter, if you're going to try to stop me from going to the cross, which is precisely why I've come, if you're going to try to stop me from doing the best thing that I could ever do for you and for all humanity, you're actually working with Satan. Get out of the way. Peter's vision, his sight spiritually, and that of the other disciples is still very blurry. They can't possibly see how the divine king could die and that be a good thing. And even though Jesus is going to spell it out very clearly two more times in Mark's gospel, they still won't get it until it actually happens. They see him crucified and then raised from the dead. And finally, it starts to click. Now, here's where we get into the real red meat for this morning. All right, you need this. Hang with me here. Peter is upset, not just because of what this means for Jesus, not just because he feels sorry for Jesus having to suffer and die. Peter's upset because of what this means for him and the other disciples. Because you see, if Jesus is just the conquering king who gets the white horse and the military and rides to Jerusalem and goes to a palace with a throne, what does that mean for the disciples? They get to ride right behind him in all that glory. But if Jesus is a divine king who came to do that by suffering and going to a cross, what does that mean for them if they're following him? Jesus spells it out, verse 34. Then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples because what he's about to say is not just for the 12, it's for anybody who's going to follow him. And he said, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of them when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels. Do you see what Jesus is saying here? A right view of Jesus leads to a right view of us. If you have a wrong understanding of what kind of king Jesus is, it's going to lead to a wrong understanding of what it means to be his follower. But Jesus is saying, if you understand what I'm getting ready to do for you, that I'm going to accomplish the best thing imaginable by laying down my life, you'll understand that the invitation to be my disciple is an invitation to a life of sacrifice. If you're going to be my follower, here's what it's going to entail. Two things. Number one, you get a new agenda. That's what Jesus is talking about when he says, deny yourself, take up your cross and follow me. It means your agenda goes to the bottom of the list. Jesus' agenda goes to the top. We like crosses, don't we? They're beautiful. We make nice jewelry out of them, like a cross necklace. I used to have a cross necklace for many years. I think I found a picture this week of me wearing that. That's me on the right. Don't take a picture of this with your phone. That would be terrible if this got out there. That's me dancing with my grandmother, and I had this gold chain that I wore for many years until it was stolen. I'm not saying not to wear cross jewelry, by the way. We make earrings out of them. Sometimes we make nice statues out of crosses. Here's a picture of one that I saw this summer at a lakeside camp. Beautiful to look at. But do you understand what the Roman was, what the cross was in the first century Roman world? It would be like wearing one of these on a necklace. You know what that is? It's the electric chair. Some of you are feeling a gut reaction to that, some shock. And that's intentional because that's what the disciples felt when Jesus said, you have to take up a cross. You can take that picture down. You see, not only was the cross an instrument of death, not only was it an instrument of torture, it was the absolute epitome of Roman evil oppression. It was the last word saying, we own you. When you are crucified, you are stripped naked and hung in front of crowds alongside the main road to die a very long, slow death. You're hanging there suffocating, pulling yourself up for a breath for hours until they finally break your legs so you can't breathe anymore. The only person who would pick up a cross and carry it was someone who was on their way to die, rejected in shame. For Jesus to say, if you want to be my follower, you got to deny yourself and take up your cross. He's saying, being my follower is expecting that your agenda, your dream for your life has to die. My agenda comes first now. Secondly, and this is going to make that first one make a little more sense. When Jesus says, deny yourself, take up your cross and follow me, it also means you get a new identity. A new identity. This is so important. He explains it in verse 35. He says, for whoever wants to save their life, that's the key word, save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. You know what he's saying here? Is he saying that if we want to have salvation, eternal life, we have to be martyrs, literally die in his name? Sounds like it, but that can't be what he's saying for two reasons. One, that would make martyrdom a work by which we earn salvation. And we know from multiple places in Scripture that we never can do anything to earn our salvation. It's a gift. But when Luke tells this story in his gospel, he includes one word that Mark left out. Jesus says that this denying yourself, taking up your cross, you have to do it daily. And you can't be a martyr daily, can you? That only happens once. You die, that's it. So there's got to be something more here, something metaphorical. Now, the key to understanding is that word I pointed out, life. Whoever wants to save their life will lose it. Whoever loses their life. In Greek, that word, if we spelled it out in English, it would look like our word psyche. But it means the core of your personhood. Your identity, the essence of who you are. Jesus is saying something that's very counterintuitive here. He's saying the more you try to define your own personhood, your identity, by what you do, what you achieve, what you accumulate, the more you're going to find it slipping through your fingers, just like sand. You can try your whole life to grasp it, to make yourself into somebody. You're going to get to the end and find out you got nothing. It was all empty. But if you will let go of that, all the things that you're trying to do to create a personhood for yourself, and you receive the new identity that I give you, you're going to find everything you're ever longing for. You're going to find a meaning, a personhood, a hope, a purpose that nothing can take away, not even death. It's a new identity. It's counterintuitive. You only get it by letting go of your efforts to define who you are. Jesus is saying that following him means getting a new agenda and a new identity, and it's a choice that we make every day of our lives. A right view of Jesus leads to a right view of us. Now, before we close, I want to just quickly show you two things. One, why this matters so much practically. And two, how you can embrace this kind of life of sacrifice, because it seems pretty hard. First, why does this matter so much? Well, if you miss the fact that Jesus was a suffering king who invites you to a life of sacrifice as you follow him, then you're going to be very disappointed, very frustrated when life happens. Because if you are like Peter in this moment, thinking that Jesus is just the conquering king who gives you a nice formula to be healthy and wealthy and prosperous in the here and now, then one, you're going to miss out on the great things Jesus really wants to do through you when you're willing to sacrifice. But two, you're going to get really frustrated when life works out to the contrary. And you don't see Jesus doing for you all those prosperous things you thought he was supposed to. You know what's going to happen? You're going to rebuke him just like Peter did. Come on, Jesus, I deserve better than this. You're going to be frustrated. But if you understand the kind of king that Jesus was and what that means for being his disciple, then when life following him gets really hard, you're not going to rebuke him. You're going to say, you know what? This is exactly what Jesus said would happen. And you're going to see him doing all kinds of wonderful things through you when you're willing to go there. I recently heard from my friend James, who is serving in a predominantly Muslim country in another part of the world. It's a part of the world where people know that if they become followers of Jesus, they're going to suffer. Their family's going to reject them. They might go to prison. They might die. It's just accepted. One of the government officials recently talked to James's coworker and said, listen, we would really hate it if one of your children got into a terrible accident, wouldn't we? So just stop talking about Jesus and that won't have to happen. And it was in that kind of environment that James came across a young girl. She was only elementary school age. She had recently fled the war in Syria with her family. She had come to a refugee camp in another country. And when she got there, someone told her about Jesus. And she was so overwhelmed by the generous, sacrificial love of Jesus that she decided right then and there to receive him, to follow him. Her family learned about her decision, and they were very upset about this. Word got out to the extended family, all the relatives. There's an infidel in the family. And they realized that they had to come and fix her before something terrible happened. And so they would come and they would make threats and they would try to talk her out of it. And James said that one by one, the same thing happened over and over as they came. They would threaten. They would say, you've got to stop this. You've got to renounce your faith in Jesus. And she would say, amazing for a young girl to think of this, but she would say, okay, I'll turn back to Islam on one condition. If you hear me out first while I tell you about Jesus. And then if you still want me to, I'll turn back. You know what happened? 41 of her relatives have become followers of Jesus because of her courage, her willingness to take the risk, to tell the story of him, what he's done for her. God's used her in incredible ways. And that doesn't happen unless you're willing to take up a cross, take up his agenda. But the last thing I want you to see, how do we do this? You may say, well, that sounds great, but I can never do this. You know, a life of sacrifice, giving up the things that are most precious to me. How do I do that? Do I just really need to muster up a lot of willpower? I would argue you actually already know how to do this. And to show you that, I want you to think for just a moment about what is most precious to you. What's the one thing that if you were asked to give it up, you would say, that's where I draw the line. I could never do that. If I lost this, I would lose me. Chances are, whatever comes to mind when I ask you that question is what you're currently looking to for your identity. It's most precious to your heart. And the only way that you're ever going to be able to loosen your grip and be willing to take up the agenda of Jesus for your life is when Jesus and his gospel, his good news, becomes the most precious thing to your heart. You know what the gospel says? It tells you what was most precious to Jesus. Oh, he could have laid claim to the other kind of kingship, the white horse, the throne, the palace, all of that. He could have had it. And yet he gave it up for something more precious. What was it? You are what was worth giving it all up for. because he didn't want to think about going through eternity without you. That's how precious you are to him. And I know that a lot of you know that with your heads, but when you really work that down into your heart, you know what's going to happen? You're going to find everything else in your life taking a different place, being reorganized. You're going to find yourself saying with your life, Jesus and the gospel are most precious to me. That's when you're able to sacrifice. That's when you're able to take up his agenda. If you really see clearly who Jesus is, you see that he's a suffering king. And you're going to realize that a right view of him leads to a right view of us. Let's bow our heads and pray. Lord, some of us are so exhausted from trying to pull ourselves up by the moral bootstraps, trying to measure up. And what we really need today, more than anything, is for your spirit to take this truth that we've heard and make it real to our hearts. That Jesus loved us, loves us so much, that he was willing to go straight to a cross for us. Would you make that real to us today? And out of that wonderful love, give us the courage to embrace the life of being disciples of Jesus. We pray in his name.